This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Ashley Flynn died 8 days before her 38th birthday. She spent her life teaching other people's children how to be better on the volleyball court, in the classroom, in Bible study groups. She was the kind of person a school district doesn't usually write public statements about, but Tip City schools did. They called her someone known for her beautiful smile, warmth, kindness, and the positive impact she had on so many, both in and out of the classroom and on the court. School districts choose their words carefully. They don't throw around language like that unless it's earned. And in Ashley Flynn's case, the people who knew her, colleagues, parents, students, neighbors, church members, have been remarkably consistent in how they described her, not performatively, not in a way that grief sometimes inflates a person's memory, but with the pain, the plain, steady clarity of people who simply lost someone who mattered. This episode, it's part three in our series about Caleb Flynn and what he's alleged to have done to his wife, obviously innocence of proven guilty. This episode is about Ashley. It's not about how she died. You heard about that story. This episode is about how she lived. Because in a case that's become defined by a 911 call, a body cam video, and an 11-count indictment, it's easy to forget that before any of that, before the headlines and the courtroom sketches and the true crime coverage, there was a woman, a real one, and her absence has left a hole in Tip City that the trial, whatever its outcome, will never fill. Ashley was born and raised in Tip City. She graduated from Tippecanoe High School in 2006. She went to Lee University in Cleveland, Tennessee, a private Christian college, and graduated in 2010. She was back home before the ink on her diploma was dry. She came back to the community she grew up in, and she built her entire adult life inside of it. She started as an elementary school teacher for Tip City Schools. Later, she worked as a substitute teacher in the same district. She coached seventh grade girls at volleyball at Tippecanoe Middle School. She taught Bible-based lessons at LifeWise Academy, a nonprofit that provides weekly off-campus religious instruction to public school students. She and Caleb both served at Christian Life Center in Butler Township, the family's home church, where she was a longtime member and participant. What stands out about Ashley's life isn't any single dramatic moment. It's the consistency. She went to the same schools her students attended. She coached in the same gymnasium where she probably played. She worshiped in the same church where she grew up. She was embedded in Tip City in a way that people who leave and come back often are deeply, intentionally, by choice, there. She could have gone anywhere after Lee University, and she decided to come back home. And it was Lee where she met Caleb. She graduated a semester before him and moved back to Ohio to be near her family. He ended up following. Their life together started in her hometown, not his. His roots, they were in Brown, Minnesota. Hers were the soil of Tip City. And that distinction matters because after Ashley was killed, it was her community, the one she'd been part of since birth, that mobilized, not for Caleb, for her, and especially for her daughters. The community response to Ashley's death wasn't a gesture. It was a full-scale mobilization. Within weeks, a GoFundMe set up to support Ashley's two elementary-age daughters had raised over $175,000 for more than 1,400 individual donors. T-shirt sales were organized across the community. LifeWise Academy, where Ashley had taught, hosted a fundraiser dinner. Local businesses directed portions of their profits to the fund. The support was not abstract. It was specific. It was organized and relentless. Ribbons appeared around Tip City. People who had never met Ashley put money into the fund because they'd met someone she taught or coached or sat next to at church. This was a town that decided collectively that whatever happened in the criminal case, two little girls were not going to face the aftermath alone. And that's what makes Tip City's response so significant. It wasn't just grief. Grief is flowers and candles and Facebook posts. It was infrastructure. This was layers and fundraisers and financial protections and guardianship arrangements. This was a community saying the system will handle the defendant, but we will handle the children. The canceled memorial tells you everything about how impossible the situation was for the people closest to it. Christian Life Center, the church where both Ashley and Caleb had served, where she worshiped and he led worship, initially announced a public celebration of life for Ashley. It was scheduled for Sunday, February 23rd, 1 week after her death. The community expected it. The church planned it. And then on Friday, February 21st, the day after Caleb's arraignment, the church pulled back. The statement was restrained and painful. Out of respect to all the families involved in the passing of Ashley Flynn, there will not be a service held at Christian Life Center on Sunday. The families have requested that a private invite-only service be held instead. Read between those lines. All the families involved. That's the church trying to hold space for a murdered woman and her accused husband at the same time. It's a congregation that said under Caleb's musical leadership on Sundays, being asked to mourn the woman he allegedly killed. The public memorial was untenable because the venue itself, the sanctuary where Caleb had stood with the guitar leading these same people in worship, had become a symbol of the contradiction at the heart of this case. Pastor Jordan Hansen released his own statement. Hearts remain heavy as we continue to grieve the tragic loss of Ashley Flynn. Ashley was a devoted wife, a loving mother, and a faithful member of Christian Life Center. Her life touched many, and her absence is deeply felt throughout the church family. Notice what the statement doesn't do. It honors Ashley. It acknowledges the community's grief. It does not mention Caleb by name. A church forced to publicly navigate the impossible, mourning a beloved member while the man who allegedly killed her was one of their own leaders. There's no protocol for that. No chapter in any pastoral handbook. They were making it up as they went, and the decision to go private was probably the only decision that made any sense. But the grief didn't stop because the memorial went private. It just kind of changed shape. It became T-shirts and GoFundMe pages and benefit dinners and whispered conversations in school parking lots. Ashley's absence was felt in specific, tangible ways. The volleyball court at Tippecanoe Middle School without its coach. The substitute teacher list without her name. The LifeWise Academy classroom with an empty chair where she used to sit with someone else's children, teaching them about faith. And then there was the legal fight, the one Ashley's family launched, not as part of the criminal case, but alongside it. You heard in the last episode about the financial filings, the life insurance policy listing Caleb as beneficiary, the family's demand for full financial transparency, the domestic violence protection order to freeze accounts. But what matters for this part of the story isn't the paperwork. It's what the paperwork represents. Ashley's family didn't wait for a verdict. They didn't wait for the system. They hired lawyers and went to the court themselves weeks before any trial date was set because two little girls needed someone to build a wall around whatever was left, and the family decided that someone was going to be them. The court agreed. It granted the motion to share investigative financial records with the children's guardians, and the guardians' attorneys inserted themselves into the defense's motion to seal case documents, making clear that the family intended to be at the table for every decision, every filing, and every move. They weren't mourners, they were combatants, and they were fighting for what Ashley would have fought for herself. At the center of all of it, at the center of the GoFundMe, the protection orders, the guardianship filings, the financial motions are two elementary age girls whose names have been kept out of the public record. They were asleep when their mother was killed. The affidavit confirms they did not wake up during the shooting. Their grandmother came to take them from the house in the early morning hours of February 16th while their father was being taken to the police station for questioning. They are now in the care of guardians who have retained legal representation on their behalf. They are the reason the community raised $175,000. They're the reason Ashley's family went to court before the criminal case was anywhere near trial. They are the people who lost the most. There's a restraint that matters here. These are children. They didn't choose any of this. Their mother's gone. Their father is in jail. Their home is a crime scene that the defense has asked the jury to tour. The family's finances are the subject of the court filings, and their future is being decided by judges and prosecutors and defense attorneys and eventually 12 strangers who will eventually sit in a jury box and weigh evidence they may never understand. The least the rest of us can do is protect their privacy while the adults in the room figure out what happens next. The defense has filed a motion for the jury view of the Flynn home, 932 Cunningham Court. If the motion is granted, 12 jurors will walk through the rooms where Ashley lived, where she raised her daughters, where she cooked and cleaned and folded laundry and helped with homework and coached volleyball plays and lived the ordinary, irreplaceable life of a mother in a small Ohio town. They'll look at that garage door. They'll see a refrigerator. They'll assess the ease of ingress or egress. They'll try to determine whether someone could have broken in the way Caleb described. But they won't see Ashley. They won't see the volleyball coach who knew every girl on her team by name. They won't see the substitute teacher who showed up every time the district called. They won't see the woman the school district described as warm and kind and impactful, because that's not the kind of evidence that gets entered into the record. The trial will determine what happened inside that house. It will weigh the 911 call and the body cam and the shell casings and the refrigerator and whatever the FBI lab at Quantico has produced. It will deliver a verdict, guilty or not guilty, and that verdict will carry legal consequences for Caleb Flynn. But the people who loved Ashley, for her parents, her family, her neighbors, her students, her volleyball players, the women who sat next to her in church, the teachers who worked alongside her, the verdict, whatever it is, won't bring her back. It won't fill the chair at the volleyball banquet. It won't put the substitute teacher's name back on the list. It won't give two little girls their mother back. Ashley Flynn was a person before she was a case. She lived in the community she grew up in, taught in the school she attended, worshipped in the church her family called home. She was 37 years old, 8 days from her birthday. And the people who knew her have made it very clear through their actions and their money and their legal filings and their grief that they intend to make sure she is remembered as more than a headline. The trial is coming, so is everything that follows it. And the people of Tip City, the ones who raised six figures in weeks, who showed up at the benefit dinners, who organized t-shirt sales, who retained lawyers for two little girls, are already making sure that whatever the jury decides, Ashley's daughters will not face the aftermath alone. It's not a legal outcome. It's a community keeping a promise to a woman who spent her life keeping promises to theirs. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. In our next final part of this story, of our four-part series, there's a lot more to come beyond the four parts, especially as this is about to go into trial. We're going to take a look specifically at the case before the jury, what they will be evaluating. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any of that, and give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue our conversation there. Links are in the description. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.